I'm Anthony Brooks. This is The Connection. First came the firm non from the French, now an even more emphatic nay from the Dutch on the proposed European Union constitution. More than 60% of Dutch voters rejected the document yesterday, coming just days after the French did the same. This week's double whammy could be fatal to the European Charter and efforts to streamline European decision-making. It's left prospects of a greater European Union in disarray and its common currency, the euro, in freefall. The message from the Eurosceptics in the Netherlands, one of the founding countries of the European Union, is hold on, not so fast. Dutch opinion polls found a nation worried about being pushed around by larger European countries, about being swallowed up in an ever-expanding 25-nation union. And many Dutch fear losing control of immigration rules that have been tightened to stem an influx from Muslim countries amidst growing ethnic tensions. Connection listeners, we're looking at how the debate over EU expansion and immigration prompted the Dutch vote no. Are concerns about loss of national identity justified, or do they smack of anti-immigrant paranoia? Is this a case of out-of-touch political leaders who fail to deliver the message, or are Europeans justified in their fear of change? Join our discussion by calling 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the European Union Connection. And we're going to start the program today in Holland, where Jim Schilder joins us on the line from Amsterdam. Jim is editor of the Dutch weekly magazine Happe de Tijd. And Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start, if I could, right here. Just give us a state, if you will, of the Dutch sort of post-referendum hangover today. What are you hearing? What are people saying explains this emphatic no vote?
Well, there are many reasons that people tell me about the backgrounds of this. There have been exit polls, and people have been asked about their reason for saying no, and there are about 20 reasons, 20 different reasons for people to have done this.
Well, give us the top sort of two or three that you hear.
The two or three are people don't like the pace in which the European Union is expanding. They also think that the euro has been a ripoff, although it isn't, but that's what many people think. And they fear for immigration, for too many people coming into the countries, and they fear for economics, for competition from Eastern European countries. Those are probably the main reasons.
We wanted to take a look this morning at the issue of immigration. Can you talk a little bit about that? What's the sector of the Dutch population that has concerns, and how do they express these concerns?
Well, these concerns have been pretty vague. Over the years, Holland tried to be multicultural, and we all believed that people would join our way of life. And in the past 3 or 4 years, it turned out that wasn't the case, especially after the murder on Theo van Gogh, the filmmaker, last November, which was committed by a young Moroccan guy. In fact, he's Dutch, but from Moroccan origin, who had integrated very well. He was very well educated. He spoke Dutch very well.
Right, and we should explain this filmmaker, Theo van Gogh, had made a film that was very controversial in the eyes of the Muslim world.
Yes, it was a very controversial film, that's true. But then we saw that apparently there is a lot of anger between young Moroccan people, especially from Morocco, against the Dutch way of life and democracy and the cultural standards that we have here, and we have had here for many years. But nobody really noticed all the anger for years, and now it turns out it's there. And that, again, makes people, Dutch people, angry and fearful, because they don't really know what many of those second-generation immigrants think or what they are up to.
I'm also hearing, Jim, that there's a great deal of concern about talk of allowing Turkey in and into the European Union as part of an expansion down the road. And, of course, this plays into the same set of fears that you're describing.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. There is a whole new look at Islam here in the country. And because many people in Turkey are Muslim, there is a sort of fear that maybe too many Muslim people will come to Holland and set the rules after a while. Many Muslims do have more children than white people have. So in the end, their numbers are growing. It's almost 40-50% in Amsterdam now, and non Dutch people, let's call it that. I mean, it's complicated because many of them are officially Dutch, but they are from a different part of the world originally.
So there's a perception among many Dutch that their country is being, what, overrun?
In the end, that many people fear that could be the result in the end. That a few weeks ago, an American gay guy was beaten up in the middle of Amsterdam. He got a lot of publicity about this because people were surprised that it happened. It was done by probably six or seven young Moroccan guys who just hate gay people. And Amsterdam used to be the gay capital of the world. So it was quite a shock that something like that could happen. And by people who probably are Muslim. And if that will set the tone, many Dutch people don't like that.
Jim Schilder in Amsterdam, stand by. I want to bring in another guest who I have right here in the studio with me, Jocelyn Cesari. She's a senior research fellow and visiting professor at Harvard's Middle East Studies Center and a professor of Islam and political science at the Sorbonne in Paris. She's also author of the book When Islam and Democracy Meet. And she's in the studio now, and thanks for being here with me, Jocelyn.
Thank you.
Let me just throw a same question to you. Give me your take on the Dutch no vote, and specifically how it contrasted with the vote by the French this past Sunday.
Mm-hmm. I think that the Dutch no really reflect the crisis of the multicultural system in the Dutch society, and this crisis is directly related to the growing presence of Muslims in the Netherlands. And I think more than any other economic or social reasons, this is the point and the major fact that explain the fear and the anger of Dutch citizens today.
Now, is that different than what went on in France? Because isn't there a good deal of fear of the same in France or not?
Less. I mean, the debate in France on the Constitution has less been on immigration than it has been on what they call the social Europe, all kinds of rights and social welfare, and the fear that we are building over there a sort of liberal Europe that will dismantle the privilege of French citizen when it comes to welfare and social rights. So there is something here that is slightly different. The debate on immigration was started by some political parties on the extreme right landscape, but it was less clear. And one also important thing that immigrant Muslims in France, like in the Netherlands actually, are growing part of French citizenry, but they are also the major bulk of the marginalized and poor citizens in France. So building a liberal, wealthy Europe built on capitalism and not taking any stand on social rights is not something that Muslims in France want. And I followed the debate among the Muslim community in France, for example. Lots of leaders called to vote no for the Constitution. So you see, this was not as clear as it is in the Dutch case about putting in the same kind of domain and reasons, rejecting the Constitution and rejecting multiculturalism. Mm. The case for France is less clear.
Jim Schilder in Amsterdam, let me come back to you on that. I mean, do you get the feeling that, I mean, if there's a country anywhere in the world that has a reputation of tolerance and liberalism, it's the Netherlands. Are the Dutch giving up a little bit on this multicultural model? I mean, is that what you take away from this vote?
Yes, I think so. I think it has gone too far in the view of many people, and maybe now they think it's time to tell people who do not agree with our way of life to explain them what our way of life is and that we like to keep it that way. And that it's time to make that clear.
Yeah. And is this a sense, do you get a sense that more and more people are getting comfortable with that attitude? I mean, is that...
I'm sure about that.
Yes, really?
I think it started a few years ago with Pim Fortuyn, a politician who has been assassinated 3 years ago. He was very outspoken about this. In the meantime, he was gay too, and he loved Moroccan boys. But at the same time, he was very outspoken about this cultural problem and about migration.
Mm. Jim, explain one thing. I understand that it's really up to the parliament to vote on the constitution, and this was really a consultative referendum. So what happens now?
Well, it's all parties made it clear that they will respect the voice of the people because it was a 60%, over 60% turnout. Now they will make clear to the government that Holland will not agree with the constitution, the European constitution.
And will there be political fallout for the Prime Minister, Jan-Peter Balkenende?
No, there will not. No, even the opposition parties made it clear in advance that they wouldn't see this as a national test. It was a European thing, and they will keep it that way.
Interesting. Let me come back to you, Jocelyn. I was reading in the Herald Tribune today that the debate, this is, I'll just read it, quote, I'll just do quote unquote, although many of the issues driving the Dutch no vote were national, the debate in the Netherlands centered more broadly on EU issues than the debate in France. So the Dutch rejection is therefore in some way a clearer test and a sharper condemnation of the EU. Do you agree with that? And we've got to make a quick response. Actually,
yes.
Let's hold that question okay. until the next segment because we need to okay. take a break. And this is The Connection. And I'm Anthony Brooks. And you can join the discussion by calling 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're talking about immigration and how it affected the no vote in Holland and what it means for the future of European Union. And join the conversation. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is The Connection. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is The Connection. We're talking about how the immigration debate is connected with voter approval of the European Union and specifically the Dutch no vote yesterday on the EU Constitution. In the studio is Jocelyn Cesari. She's a senior research fellow and visiting professor at Harvard's Middle East Studies Center and a professor of Islam and political science at the Sorbonne in Paris. And joining me now on the line from Brussels is George Parker. He's the Brussels Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. And hello, George.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us this morning. Let me just get your take very quickly, first of all, about what you're hearing in Brussels there. This must be a tough morning for EU leaders to wake up to.
Yeah, there are a lot of very gloomy faces around the place. This is probably the worst crisis, political crisis, the European Union's ever faced. The rejection of a treaty like this, a sort of refounding treaty, if you like, of the European Union by France and the Netherlands, two of the founding members of the club, is a huge sort of emotional and psychological blow to the whole project. Mm-hmm. And I think the first consequence of it is that the constitution is dead. And the second thing is there's a lot of people waking up today thinking, where on earth do we go from here?
It's a good question. Connection listeners, join this conversation by calling us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. What are the French and Dutch voters saying no to? That's one of the questions we'd like to explore with you and our guests. Let me restate the question that I put out right before the end of that break, of the last break, and that is, and let me start with you, George. Was the Dutch vote in some ways more of a rejection even than the French vote, a sharper and clearer condemnation of the EU than even the French vote was on Sunday, in your view?
I think the Dutch, well, if you looked at the size of the no vote, it was certainly bigger in the Netherlands than it was in France. So on that basis, you could say it was a sharper rejection. And lots of people in Brussels are trying to read things into the no votes and trying to analyse what they actually meant. But as someone put it at a press conference this morning, what part of no don't you understand? These are no votes. You know, you can't get away from it. So I think the Dutch no was obviously numerically bigger. The Dutch no rejection of the treaty was more diverse. As we've been just hearing, there were probably 20 or even 30 reasons why Dutch voters rejected the constitution, from everything from inflation under the euro, the single currency, to immigration. Whereas in France, it was a much more focused debate, I think. The French were rejecting the constitution because they saw the European Union heading in what they like to call an Anglo-Saxon direction, the sort of a British-American model of red-blooded capitalism. And there was a very strong element of that being rejected. Incidentally, if there had been a referendum in Britain on the same constitution, the exact opposite arguments would have been advanced by the No campaign. In Britain, the constitution was seen as too French.
Too French. Interesting. Jocelyn Cesari, same question to you. I mean, was this a clearer condemnation of the EU constitution?
I would like to say yes and no. Yes, because it's clear that French citizens have expressed fear and concern on the future of this building process. What does it mean? And I think that we didn't measure the misunderstanding and ignorance that people suddenly reached when the European jumped at 25. Mm. I mean, this has never really underlined, but there was a sort of familiar Europe, you know, the neighbors, the Germans, the Belgians, the British, old enemies also, so create familiarity. And suddenly the frontier of Europe expanded to 25, to countries and people that are not really known and that are not in the mind or the map of the French mind, and I think we didn't measure that, and French were not consulted for that. Mm. And the no to the constitution is in some way a no also, like the Dutch, on the pace, on the rhythm of this expansion, what does it mean, plus economic concern also, plus the role of French politics in this kind of new arrangement and configuration. So in some way, it's a no to Europe, but it's true that the growing illegitimacy of the government and the growing frustration of French citizens with their politicians got into the picture in a way that doesn't, I think, affect the Dutch vote in the same way.
Connection listeners, you can join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And let's go to one of our listeners now. Stephen is calling from Canton, Massachusetts. Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
Thanks for the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I do this for a living. I'm a change agent, a community relations person. And it's always been a mystery to me the pace that this is taking place. Hmm. In other words, I believe it's been, 15 years that this has all been going through. Very short period of time. I mean, you know, I look at my world history and I think about the wars that were fought through Europe amongst the European members. And 15 years is a short period of time to have changed the currency, to change the political system. The document, 300 pages long, obviously very complex. But I look at it as, the first time you meet someone, they may say, you say you're interested in doing business, and they may say, no, not today. We don't know what else is going on, but I think it's just a taste of time. I wouldn't say it's a no. I think there's a tremendous logic here, I think, that underlies it. But it's going to take time. It might take another 10 years for this to happen.
What do you think, George Parker, there in Brussels? Is this a question of just a little more time, or is there something more fundamental going on here?
I think the caller is absolutely right. The things have moved much faster than a lot of Europeans would have liked. I just really don't think there was a public debate at all about the most recent enlargement of the European Union. This took place in May 2004, which brought in 10 new member states, mainly from the former communist bloc. And things seem to be almost accelerating, I think, in the eyes of many people in what you could probably call the older member states, places like France and Germany, where they see Romania and Bulgaria lining up to join in 2007. And beyond that, places like Turkey, Ukraine, and many of the former Yugoslavia republics. So I think the European Union has changed very quickly. It has been an incredible process over the last 15 years or so. The introduction of a single currency, the introduction of a common foreign policy, which is obviously not always particularly effective, but it's there after all. The European Union is trying to do a bit more in coordinating its response to asylum, immigration, terrorism. There's a whole lot of things that the European Union is doing. I think the rejection of this constitution in France and the Netherlands was really people saying, just hang on a moment. You know, we haven't been asked about this up until now. This is the first chance we've had to give our view on this, and we've had enough.
Jocelyn Cesari, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I do agree. The pace is quick, fast. I would like to add another reason. I think that all these changes have been until now very bureaucratic and technical. And I think what is missing in Europe in the building process is really a political narrative that would be appealing to a lot of segments of European societies and especially the young people. I mean, until now, the European Union building is seen as a bureaucratic process. You know, when people say Brussels, they mean a very specialized place where people think for them, writing treaties of, as we said, of 30 pages long with technical features and so on. And they don't understand what would be a story for them in this new building. I think this is very important, and it's a responsibility of all national political classes today.
So the political leaders really haven't made a case that resonates to the man on the street, it
no,
sounds like you're
and,
saying.
And, you know, in France also, French politicians are paying the cost, so to speak, of a particular rhetoric along the years. When something goes wrong in France, they say it's Brussels' fault. It's not our fault. It's Brussels' fault. So at some point, you know, French have taken this on. What is Brussels' fault? It means so something is going wrong. And they really now are saying it clearly through this no.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join the EU connection. Let's go to Peter, who's calling from North Carolina, from Durham, North Carolina. Hello, Peter.
You hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you loud and clear. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, I was living in Bretagne, France. That's Brittany, France. I was there the last 8 months. Spectacular time. And, of course, I was there for the heated debate. And it's been a big debate in France. And I just want to talk about a few things that haven't been covered and why France voted no.
Sure. Pick one or two. Pick one or two, Peter, and let
okay,
us let
I'll
us
pick,
know.
I'll pick one right here, which is the big one. Is that, as you guys know, in 2002... they had the French runoff, and the left got destroyed, and Le Pen and Chirac came out in the end. And since then, Chirac's party, and with Nicolas Sarkozy, they have been, you know, winning the battles and all the political battles, and the left has just been slowly been put in its place and hasn't been able to speak on anything. And this vote was the first referendum, the first vote from the left to be able to say, look, take that, Chirac, take that, Sarkozy. We're not happy with the way things are moving here. And in that sense, and you look at it that way, and really this vote was not so much about the EU. It was specifically about the way France is going.
Well, let me put that point, Peter, to Jocelyn Cesari, who's here in the studio, and get her response to that. It sounds like Peter's talking about internal French politics driving this vote more than sort of an appreciation of European-wide policies. Is that fair?
It did absolutely influence the vote, and it did shape the debate on the vote and the referendum. But it's not the only reason. It's a very important reason, but it's not the only one. There are also concerns on the identity of Europe and the future of Europe as such, I think.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to make the connection on the European Union vote. We're taking a look at the vote yesterday in Holland, the emphatic no vote, which followed the French vote on Sunday. And Peter, thank you for your call. Let me come back to you, George Parker, and this sort of picks up on a point that Jocelyn was making. And it seemed like a moment ago she was saying that, you know, this is a case of some really bad political spin, political leaders being wildly out of step with many voters. I'm wondering if you can pick up on that point and agree or disagree with that.
Well, I think that's certainly true, that the politicians really have been building this construction in Brussels, this great European Union project, without really explaining to their people what was going on. And there's been a corrosive increase over the years of Brussels bashing, people just blaming all of their domestic problems on the European Union. It's been a phenomenon in my country, the UK, for the best part of 30 years. And as a result, the United Kingdom has the most Eurosceptic population in Europe. But we've seen a lot more of that in recent years in France, in Germany, in Italy. It's a very damaging state of affairs because there are certain things in the European Union, in particular the euro, the single currency, which depend upon a high level of European solidarity and faith in a common project. And it seems to me that if you get a breakdown of that sort of trust and faith in the institutions of Europe and between the member states, then things like the euro could eventually come under threat.
Mm. I'm also struck by something both of you have alluded to, and that is how Brussels almost becomes a sort of whipping boy, almost a scapegoat. Mm. I was in Italy recently, and when I would talk to people about how things were going, they would complain about the economy, about the euro, and then sort of shrug and say it's all Brussels' fault. And there was no sort of connection with, you couldn't get anything from them more specific than that, but just this vague notion that we have the euro costs us more, things are more expensive, and it's Brussels' fault, and we don't like it, as opposed to looking at their own internal policies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is growing all over Europe. I mean, it's a hint, it's a symptom of a bigger crisis and an identity crisis. I mean, we have insisted all on the rapidity of the pace building this Europe. We have also to insist on the, in some way, unique experience of building Europe on the basis of old nations. We are not building an empty place like the United States, building on you know, bringing people in from here. In Europe, the point has been these nations have been fighting each other. They have been knowing each other for long, long centuries, long time centuries, and suddenly they have to build something together to overcome the nationalistic rhetoric and identity, to build something together. And I think that this takes time, and it's going to take maybe longer than building economic Europe. But it's worth it to pay more attention to what European citizens are saying about it right now. Mm.
Let's go to Thurman, who's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Thurman, hello.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Sure. I think that Europe really blew it. I think they had an opportunity to create a counterbalance to the Bush administration's foreign policy. And instead, they allowed economic misconceptions and racial hatred to destroy really the only chance they had to influence geopolitics. So the next time the Bush administration may pursue a military option, say, against Syria or towards Iran, I think Europe lost, if Europe creates some opposition to that, it lost a lot of credibility by not forming this unified voice towards this opposition.
Interesting. George Parker, what do you make of that? I mean, was there a potential here for Europe to really come together and present a sort of political counterbalance to the U.S.?
Well, I think you have to put it within context. The European Union is never going to be a military superpower like the United States, obviously. But as an agent of projecting soft power and military economic muscle around the world, then certainly there was a great opportunity. After the Iraq war, where the Europeans completely fell out, there was an attempt to get things back together again, and the common foreign policy of Europe started to show some results. They worked quite well together in persuading the Ukrainians to have a second election just before Christmas. And the European Union's working very well in presenting an alternative policy to the Bush administration's in its dealings with Iran to try to get them to stop their nuclear program through economic and diplomatic means. However, I agree entirely with your caller that the European Union risks making itself look absolutely absurd with this, because the risk is that Europe will now start having a interminable navel-gazing debate about its institutions and where do we go from here and what do we do wrong, rather than facing outwards to the world, which was what this constitution was supposed to do. Just to remind your listeners, the constitution was supposed to give the European Union a full-time president and a foreign minister and a diplomatic service, and the whole aim of that was to give Europe a sharper focus on the world stage. Now we're going to lose the constitution as a result of these no votes, and we're going to see a lot of internal squabbling, and I can see the people in the Bush administration just looking in disbelief at what's going on over here.
Mm. Jocelyn Cesario, lost opportunity in this regard?
Yeah. I think so too, yeah. I mean, this is a lost opportunity. This was really the moment to start building this political Europe, and this is paralyzed, I think, for several years now. Having said that, the history of Europe has always also been, you know, difficult. I mean, there have been no along the road several times, not at this level or intensity, but each time Europeans come with alternatives. So, but for now, this political document is paralyzed and won't be used for sure.
Connection listeners, let's pick up that question after a short break. You can join this conversation by calling 1-800-423-8255. How do you think this no vote affects the relationship between an expanding Europe and the United States? Call with your question, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. This is The Connection. I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll be back after a short break. This is The Connection. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Dick Gordon. We're talking about the Dutch no vote to the EU Constitution yesterday, how fear of immigration may have played a role in that vote, and what it means in terms of relationships to the United States and the future of a larger European Union. With me is Jocelyn Cesari. She's here in the studio. She's a senior research fellow and visiting professor at Harvard's Middle East Studies Center. And George Parker is on the line from Brussels. He's bureau chief for the Financial Times. And we'd like to take your calls. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And let's go to Ben, who's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hello, Ben.
Good morning. How are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, it's a sad day for me to see that they're voting against Muslims. You know, the whole world has given the United States, a bad name, saying, you know, what a bad country we are and all that, because we're over in Iraq trying to help people. We've helped Muslims around the world, and now these countries that have always told us that we're the bad guys voted against Muslims. I mean, that to me is a crime almost.
Well, let me put that point to our guest, Jocelyn Cesari. Clearly, a sort of anti-immigrant sentiment was part of it, but it's probably not the whole story.
Let me first tell you a few things about the difference between Europe and the U.S. when it comes to Muslims. First, you have to understand that Muslims in Europe are mostly immigrants. So they are seen as immediately as external, initially external, and there is a process of integration. The second dimension, which is very important and also very different from the US, is they are all very fragile, socioeconomically speaking. We are talking about people who are in the lower rank of the socioeconomic ladder in Europe, which is not the case of all Muslims in America. So in America, all Muslims are not immigrant and they are not socioeconomically fragile. And the third reason that is shared on both sides, actually, is the association connection of Islam with international political problems and the war on terror. And so the convergence of these three aspects make the life, the condition of Muslims all over Europe very, very difficult right now, because there is a sort of automatic connection between Islam, poverty, socioeconomic problems, and security. And I think that you have different national variation of this equation, so to speak. In the Dutch case and in other, for example, post-Scandinavian countries, the problem is related to multiculturalism, meaning multicultural policies in Europe have been adopted in the 60s and 70s to face the challenge of integrating Muslim immigrants. And these policies have failed, as it was said earlier. So suddenly there is a sort of fear and threat from Dutch citizens that Muslims are not sharing their basic values, and also the basic values in Europe are not automatically political values, but cultural values, for example, on recognition and tolerance for homosexuality. And I think the crisis in the Dutch society is very, very much related to the misunderstanding between Muslims and the Dutch on recognizing homosexuality.
George Parker, I want to get you back into this conversation. I know you have to go very shortly, but chime in if you will, and respond to Ben's point, who called from Raleigh, North Carolina, about this being a slap in the face of Muslims in Europe.
Well, I think there certainly was an anti-Muslim vote in the Netherlands, but I don't think it was by any means the most important part of the vote in Holland against the European Constitution. I think there's a general resistance to immigration generally, and I think the anti-Muslim backlash is obviously part of that. But if you look at the French debate as well, what we've been hearing a lot of is anti-immigration feeling, and it's not based on colour necessarily. In the French debate, there was this bogeyman of the campaign who was the Polish plumber, who featured in all of the campaign material, and the idea was that since the European Union expanded to the east, that French jobs were being taken by low wage, low skill Polish plumbers, and he became a big figure of the French campaign. So I think the feeling about Muslims in the Netherlands was also part of a general feeling against immigration. And the countries in Europe which are most anti-immigration at the moment are the ones with the weakest economies and the highest unemployment. If you look around Europe, countries like Spain, which recently naturalised about a million mainly Muslims into their society, or the UK, which has its a very open door policy, or Sweden, these are the countries whose economies are doing very well. The countries which have turned their backs on immigration tend to be the countries which are suffering from serious economic problems, and the two things are completely interlinked, I think.
Interesting. George, before we say goodbye to you, let me just ask you finally, where do we go with this process from here? You said at the beginning of the hour that this vote means the EU constitution is effectively dead. What happens next?
Well, it's very hard to say how the constitution can be revived now because it has to be approved by all 25 member states. So to bring it back to life, you'd have to go back to the French voters and the Dutch voters and ask them exactly the same question in the hope that one day they might change their minds. I think that's highly unlikely. It's a difficult time for the European Union because there's a famous bicycle model for the development of the European Union, which is you have to keep pedalling the thing forward, otherwise it falls over. And without this constitution there to aim at, there's no more big projects for the Europeans to aim for. And so there's a question about what the European Union does. The traditional leadership of the EU has come from countries like France and Germany, both of which have very weak leaders at the moment. There's a lack of leadership in Europe. There's a lack of big projects. There's a general air of distrust among the members. So it's very hard to see how we get out of this thing. I think probably the best hope for Europe is that a new generation of leaders comes through, and we'll see that probably in the next few years. President Chirac in France will almost certainly be out of office in 2007. Gerhard Schroeder of Germany, we expect, will be out of office in the general election this September. So we could have a new face to Europe. If we get new leaders in Germany and France, they're likely to be slightly more open to liberal economic reforms. They're more Atlanticist as well if we get someone like Sarkozy in France or Angela Merkel in Germany. So we could see a new consensus developing of a more sort of realistic, reform-minded, outward-looking Europe. But at the moment, it's a pretty dire state of affairs, and people are looking very downcast at the moment.
Okay, George Parker, Bureau Chief of the Financial Times, talking to us on the line from Brussels. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
I appreciate you being with the show. Connection listeners, please join us, 800-423-8255, and we're going to go to Ed, who's calling from Grafton, Massachusetts. Hello, Ed.
Hello.
You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, I was wondering if people think there are analogies between the development of the U.S. Constitution and the European Constitution, and this whole debate that happened in the United States and has continued about states' rights versus federal rights.
Interesting.
And I was, I don't know that history really well, but we did have Articles of Confederation that had to be completely redone for the Constitution. The first one failed. And I do wonder whether it ever would have passed if the states had had more time to develop their individual personalities and if there had been universal suffrage at the time of the Constitutional Convention.
So your point is that Europe has had so much time to have so much history that it's going to be very difficult for them to come together.
Well, I'm wondering about that, and I'm wondering whether Europe ever has looked at all the United States and its experience of working out the problem. Yeah. Of federal versus state rights.
It's an interesting question,
Josh. Whether this is part of what's going on.
Yeah, I want to throw this over to Jocelyn Cesari. You were sort of making a point along these lines a little while ago about this.
Yeah, I was mentioning the difference between Europe and the U.S. politically and culturally speaking. I'm not sure that the American Constitution was in the mind of the European bureaucrats and politicians when they shaped the Constitution. Of course, there is a debate on the level of sovereignty of the different old nation states and of the future new political entity, and this has been on the table for a long, long time. But I'm not sure that the U.S. way can be reproduced or imitated in Europe right now because the historical and political conditions are very, very different.
Ed, thanks for the call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the connection conversation about the expansion of the EU and what this no vote in the Netherlands means. I'm here in the studio with Jocelyn Cesari. She's a senior research fellow and visiting professor at Harvard's Middle East Studies Center. And Jocelyn, I have a very specific question about really what was in this proposed constitution. One of the themes we've been talking mm-hmm. about is a sort of backlash against immigration and the influx of Muslims. Does the proposed constitution actually say anything about that? And were people actually voting specifically about that? Or was it a more vague reaction to the process?
Yeah, I think it was a more vague reaction. The Constitution doesn't deal with immigration per se. The Constitution is a political document to create a sort of political leadership in Europe today. It deals with the creation, for example, of a foreign minister, foreign affairs minister, of different arrangement that would create Europe as a political entity and not only as an economic market. So the question of immigration was mentioned, but it was not central in the document. Mm. It was talking about social rights. It was talking about economy. It was talking about different kinds of guarantees and measures that would create Europe politically.
Yeah. I mean, I ask the question because it's hard to imagine voters as sophisticated and as well-informed as they might be really digesting a 300-page document that's been put together by bureaucrats in Brussels. And so it's hard to imagine that they were really voting on the specifics of that document.
You're absolutely right. I mean, as in any other election, people are not, I mean, don't get to the source right there. They listen to different interpretations that come up in the public space. And I think that the immigration question came out in the French debate, I would say less than in the Dutch debate. But, I mean, the question was more on what kind of Europe are we building? Is it a liberal Europe that will dismantle all our social rights? Mm. Or is it another kind of Europe taking into account economic concerns, equality between citizens? And immigration came in the debate, as it was said, as a way to you know, as a way through which the competition between citizens and the competition from outside was seen as a threat, actually.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Kishore, who's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yes, you are. Thank you very much for taking my question.
Good, sure. What's on your mind?
Well, my question relates actually to the thesis proposed in Parin Zakaria's book, The Future of Freedom, but that sometimes too much democracy is not a good thing. By giving this decision to the populace and giving it in a referendum perspective, you're expecting the populace to make a decision that's maybe too complex, too sophisticated to understand all the benefits and all the detriments. And so it's pawning off the decision when it should be made by bold leaders that are ready to make change, when maybe right now the electorate is not ready to make change, but they should be.
But Kishore, what would be the alternative?
The alternative would be, let's say, an elected legislature would be able to make that decision. The same way the idea that you have representatives in the U.S. who are making decisions for the people. So for the idea of a republic where you don't actually have to have the individual making very complex decisions.
Well, so in the case of the Netherlands, for example, my understanding is the parliament was prepared to vote in favor of the constitution, mm-hmm. but they checked with the electorate in this referendum. Respond, if you would, to Kishore, Jocelyn. What about that idea? Was this a case of too much democracy being a bad thing?
Yeah, I think it's a good point, yeah. I mean, but in the same time, it was true also in France, there were other ways to have this document voted that would not have, you know, involved the electorate. But the choice was made to consult them. And I think that at some point, Europe won't be a political success if European citizens are not involved in it. It can't just be a specialized or political process. It has to involve the adherence, the attraction of people all over Europe. There is something here that need to be done and that has not been done yet.
Kishore, thanks for the call. Great question. Let's go now to Stephen, who's calling from Fayetteville, North Carolina. Hello, Stephen.
Hi.
You're on. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to say, in regards to one of the callers earlier, they said it seemed to seem like it was a very anti-Muslim decision, but I think it was more that each country kind of feels like they want to keep their national identity. When I went to Denmark recently, And each country, I toured around, but each country really seemed like, oh, you know, we're French and we wanna be French. And I think that's the reason why these countries voted against it, because they see the immigration as it's kind of breaking down their cultural heritage, and they want to hold on to it.
So the new arrivals weren't really regarded as Europeans by these various nations.
I think it's like a culture clash. They want to hold on to their European culture. They want to hold on to their specific national cultures. And when immigration comes in, it kind of turns away from that, and they can't really focus on it. I mean, it kind of breaks it down. Like, it's no longer, you know, we're Dutch because you have all these other cultures mixing into it.
Yeah, Jocelyn Cesari, you want to jump in on that?
I do agree with that. I mean, beyond the economy concerns, and there is a deep crisis of identity in Europe. And to finish up maybe on the comparison with America, American citizens and new immigrants are less fearful or have less distrust in the American values that most Europeans have today, in what could be European values. And I think we have to measure that. I mean, even after 9/11, the American patriotism and national identity is strong, including new immigrants, newcomers in this country. And I have never witnessed the same level of trust, the same level of empathy with European values in all the different European countries. And this crisis of identity has to be now faced, I think.
Stephen, thanks for the call. And obviously this is a topic that we're going to go on talking about for years and years to come. And I want to thank you, Jocelyn Cesari, for coming in. And thanks to our callers, everyone who called. Jocelyn Cesari is a visiting professor from the Sorbonne at Harvard's Middle East Studies Center and Divinity School, and author of When Islam and Democracy Meet, Muslims in Europe and the United States. Earlier we spoke with George Parker, Brussels Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, and Jim Schilder, an editor with the Dutch weekly magazine Hape de Tijd. And you can continue this discussion on our website, theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Sarah Baker, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Madison, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, Doug Sugarts, and Mary Stack. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is The Connection.